surrounding a lot of the political discussions that happen nationally, there's actually very little discussion and a tremendous amount of debate. Now, debate is very different from conversation because the purpose of a conversation is to achieve common ground and to find something you can actually talk about. The purpose of a debate is to win.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the foundation, our history, and our programs, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. In late February, an article ran on both Kaiser Health News and CNN heralding a new psychiatric diagnosis, post-election stress disorder. The Wall Street Journal had an article titled, "Take Back Your Brain from Social Media." Science of Us, Not to Be Outdone, offered, "How to Follow All This Trump News Without Going Crazy." There was another in the same publication, "You're Not the Only One. America Just Broke a National Stress Record." And that is just the tip of the iceberg. Just about everywhere you look, media outlets are offering hot takes, personal accounts, and advice on dealing with our frazzled nerves. At the center of this, of course, is our new president, along with everything that could be said and certainly felt about the effect that his distinct political style has on people's ability to just keep calm. Joining us today are two University of Texas professors, Christopher McCarthy and Art Markman, who will offer some wisdom and advice on keeping our wits amid what feels to many like overwhelming uncertainty. First up, Christopher McCarthy is a professor in the Department of Educational Psychology in the College of Education and a leading authority on stress and coping. Dr. McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So most of your research is on stress and coping in educational settings.
Yep.
Call me naive, but I would think that what might work for stressed out teachers and counselors could apply to most anyone. So is there anything about our current moment that's in any way comparable to the kinds of phenomena that you examine in your work?
Yes, I think so. A lot of the research that I do with teachers is trying to understand how stress affects their daily lives, given that they work in very complex environments. So they work in schools where they're responsible for many different stakeholders, students, parents, other teachers, administrators. And so they are just dealing with a variety of different changes. And I think that's got a lot of parallels to what people are experiencing today in general, which is living in a very complex society, being fed information all the time, adjusting to rapid change, and all of that results in stress.
Okay. There's tons of advice on stress management out there.
Yes.
In your honest opinion, what are some of the most and least helpful things that you see people doing in response to the current climate?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's important to understand about stress is that the stress response that we're all familiar with, where we start feeling anxious, we start having physiological symptoms like increased heart rate, restlessness, inability to sleep, all of that is hardwired into us. And our brains really, once the stress response is triggered, our bodies don't really differentiate whether the threat is an onrushing tiger or whether it's a political change that has someone worried. So one of the things that's really important about stress is understanding how our body reacts and separating that from the psychological piece of it.
Okay. For a lot of people, who are good at managing stress, they have an array of coping mechanisms.
Right, right.
That may not be so obvious as just taking deep breaths and counting to 10.
Right.
So what are some examples of those?
Well, so what I was talking about as far as like the physiological response to stress that we all know about, we feel worried and all the things I just mentioned, that's what most people think of when they think of stress management. They think of things to deal with that immediate physiological response. And that can be very helpful in the moment because we all need to get past those moments so we can cope with whatever we need to cope with. But I think the most important thing for coping is really to build one's resources. And resources are just a wide variety of psychological assets. They have to do with social relationships. They have to do with healthy beliefs about ourselves. And the people who are able to cope most effectively with stress don't just worry about the short term. They try and build resources for themselves throughout their lives that inoculate themselves from stress.
Okay. And do you have, like, off the top of your head, a particularly illustrative example, even if it's off the beaten path?
Yeah, I really think one that's kind of obvious in some ways is really social relationships. Having healthy relationships with other people is a good way to prevent stress, because people who have problematic relationships with family members, with partners, with friends, often find themselves constantly moving from one stressful situation to another. People who are really good at building rich and diverse social networks, be it at work, be it with family, with romantic partners, they often find not only does that reduce stress, but it's a resource to call upon when they do encounter a challenge or something that's particularly stressful.
Okay. One thing that I can't help but wonder is how much, you know, your own reality may have changed since the election. If there's been any uptick in how sought after you are as an advice giver.
That's an interesting question. I mean, definitely I notice in the people that I work with and those around me that, stress is much more on their minds. I think oftentimes people are looking for ways to like connect with other people and find ways to kind of build support systems. I think it's also important to just keep in mind that many of the strategies we sometimes use to cope are not necessarily the things that are going to make things better. And by that, I mean, sometimes people want to kind of cope with political turmoil or change by getting more information, you know, watching cable news and
right.
stuff on Facebook.
And guilty.
Yeah, I think we're all probably guilty of that. But in some ways, that doesn't help us as far as our own like kind of feeling of well-being, because we're constantly kind of inundating ourselves with information about things that are happening in far off places or in different parts of the country. And while awareness is good, a lot of times, in effect, what we're doing is sending threat signals to ourselves, you know, about which we can do nothing. And so one of the most stressful situations to be in is to feel like you don't have a sense of control. So when we're watching things, we're watching news reports about things happening in other places, we lose a sense of control. So I think when people can kind of reclaim that control, do things locally, make change in their immediate environment, that could often help with that feeling of hopelessness.
Okay. So one thing about our current president that I think is worth noting,
mm-hmm.
Is that conflict and drama seem to be his natural element.
Yeah, his natural coping style.
This is just my own opinion. Yeah, I know shared by many others, but it just seems second nature to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's without even touching his political ideology.
Yeah, yeah.
So, of course, that's fundamentally at odds with people's need to feel reassured and relaxed.
Yes.
So because of this, is there anything else you think people should know beyond the advice that you'd normally give?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there are people like that who that's how they operate in the world, and that is something that maybe in some sense clearly works for them. I mean, I guess in some sense it works for the current president because he is president, so somehow he got to where he is doing what he does. But I think that often doesn't work for the rest of us. So, and particularly if you're on the receiving end of some of those changes in terms of like public policy and things like that. So I think there's a couple of pieces to really coping with that. I think one is what I already mentioned, which is trying to be a bit selective about the information that you receive. How much of your time do you really want to devote to that? Is it really productive to do those kinds of things? And also really to focus on what you can do in your immediate environment to give yourself a better sense of control. You know, I think sometimes we get false signals about what's happening to us because we rely so much on news that is pretty much a kind of negative spin to it and is focused mainly on negative events that happen. So I think reclaiming our own sense of security has to do with really taking stock of, you know, what's happening in our world. What can we do to maximize certainty in our own world with the things that are really important to us? And usually that's our relationships, our jobs, our interests. And so I think reclaiming some of that and kind of keeping focus there is not, I wouldn't say it's a way of putting your head in the sand. I'd say it's a way more of like having a personal agenda that's going to maximize your own well-being.
Are there any specific changes that you've made since the election?
Well, yes, I have stopped listening to AM radio. I've stopped listening to most of the cable news networks. I don't want to say guilty in the past of listening to a lot of different stuff and oftentimes treating it as entertainment sometimes. And I think I found for myself that was not going to be helpful in the current environment. So again, I think focusing more on the work that I do with working with students, doing research is really where I found my passion. So some of those other things I'm trying to see as distractions and things that I don't really want to focus my energy on right now.
Okay, so listeners, take heed. Social relationships, information filtration, and then all of the healthful things that you would otherwise normally do.
Right.
Please keep doing them.
Yep.
Dr. McCarthy, thank you so much for taking the time to share your insight with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Our next guest, Art Markman, is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Texas. He is the co-host of the popular podcast and radio show, Two Guys on Your Head. He's the author of Smart Thinking, Three Essential Keys to Solve Problems, Innovate, and Get Things Done. His field is cognitive science, and his specialty is the study of similarity. Dr. Markman, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much.
So last December, you wrote a piece that appeared in Texas Perspectives on the UT News website. It was titled, This Holiday Season, Listen and Converse, Don't Debate. What was the main thrust of your argument, and how does it relate to your research?
So I've done research in a lot of different areas. I almost anything you could think of as thinking is a part of what I do. And one of the things that I've spent time doing is looking at what people learn from the conversations that they have. And one of the fascinating things about conversation is that when you talk with somebody else, you actually have to look at the world the way they do in order to understand what they're saying when you truly have a conversation. And as a result, you walk away from that interaction thinking about the world more similarly to the person you were talking to than you did when you walked in. Now, that's a research finding, and we had done studies on things like how people learn categories by this kind of conversation. But when you extend this out to look at the kinds of things people are doing in the world, you notice that surrounding a lot of the political discussions that happen nationally, there's actually very little discussion and a tremendous amount of debate. Now, debate is very different from conversation because the purpose of a conversation is to achieve common ground and to find something you can actually talk about. The purpose of a debate is to win. And if you're trying to win, you don't necessarily want to address exactly what someone said. You often want to talk over them or around them or reframe the entire discussion. And consequently, you're not really working that hard to understand what they said. So a lot of what I was talking about in that piece was, hey, we're going to be getting together over the holidays or at any time with people who we may not agree with politically. How should we approach that? Now, one way that people often approach it is just to steer the conversation to anything else other than the topic you disagree about. And my feeling is that that wastes an opportunity, because when you have somebody in your life that you disagree with, having a conversation to understand what they're really thinking about and really trying to engage them is incredibly important.
Okay. So if a lot of people are like me, an admittedly dangerous assumption, they may have a vague idea of what they hope they'll do the next time they're in a conversation with someone of diametrically opposed political views. It never seems as if I'm quite ready for that, you know? But it's impossible to predict everything that another person will throw at you.
That's right.
And are there any like simple, repeatable techniques for navigating those situations?
Well, the purpose of having a conversation is really to just find some ways that you think similarly to somebody else. And partly the conversations are about understanding someone else. I mean, one of the things that frustrated me was the number of people who, after the last election, would, depending on which side they were on, say, "I can't understand how someone would have voted for X," where X was whoever the candidate you didn't vote for. And so in many ways, the preparation for the conversation is more about being willing to engage rather than to immediately try to change somebody's mind. To ask questions. When somebody says something that seems out of left field to you, to ask questions, to try to understand their assumptions, and then to share your assumptions, not in a spirit of, you have no idea what you're talking about, so let me set you straight, but rather, "That's interesting. You know, I always think of it in a different way. I come at it from this perspective." And to just try to share where you're coming from on this, rather than trying to make the ultimate desired end state of the conversation be that the other person now believes what you believe.
Okay, and so while poking around on your website, I came across a YouTube video titled "How to Build a Culture of Empathy with Science." Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah. So that particular podcast was by somebody who spends a lot of time talking with a variety of people about empathy. And to me, one of the things that you want to do is to use this technique of having real conversations with people. And to do that in the spirit of making the assumption that people that you're talking to are just as smart and just as decent a person as you are. Even if you come away later deciding that's not true, it's better to come away with that conclusion later than immediately. And a lot of times what happens is we assume that someone who believes very differently from us, there must be something wrong with them, that they don't, because they don't see all the things that we see. And chances are most people have families and friends and goals and things that they want to accomplish in life, just like we do. But their set of experiences has led them to a different conclusion. And so if you drop the judgment from the front end of the conversation and just talk, you at least get to understand where they're coming from, rather than assuming from the beginning that there's something seriously wrong with them. And often what happens is actually two interesting things. One, you now understand why people might come to a very different conclusion. Again, even if you still disagree with them. But secondly, you often walk away from these conversations with some sense of common ground with people that you thought you had nothing in common with whatsoever. And that can also be really valuable.
Okay. So do you have an illustrative example of a time that your own ability to empathize was sorely tested? And what were the circumstances and what was the result?
So I had a very interesting experience about a year ago now. And so in full disclosure, my politics sit somewhat left of center. And I had posted, I rarely post anything political on my Facebook page, but I posted an article in a community newspaper that annoyed me, that was suggesting that everyone go out and consider buying a firearm for their home. And they made a somewhat disparaging comment about suicide, which is actually the single largest cause of death by firearms. And I got a little upset about that, being someone who's read these statistics. And so I posted something on my Facebook page, and someone who was not a Facebook friend of mine actually responded. And we had a little back and forth on the comment section of Facebook, at which point this person said, well, it sounds like you have very strong opinions. You want to have a debate about this? We could have a public debate. I said, you know, I won't have a debate, but I will have a conversation. And I invited this guy out for coffee. And I don't think I've ever been so frightened of the prospect of having a cup of coffee with somebody in my life. And I really was worried that I was going to get, you know, uncomfortable or angry in the conversation. As it turned out, we spent about 10 minutes just getting to know each other a little bit, because we really weren't people who knew each other before. And then kind of got into a discussion about firearms. And it turns out that while we disagree on a large number of dimensions, we actually found several places where even this person I was talking to felt like there were regulations that ought to be put in place that haven't been put in place. And by the end of the conversation, while we understood each other a little better and agreed to disagree on a lot of things, we actually ended up deciding to write an op-ed piece together that was published in several newspapers, saying, here we are, two people who sit on opposite sides of one of the most contentious issues in American politics right now. But we got together and had a conversation, and lo and behold, we discovered here are three things that both of us agree that the government ought to be doing to control firearms, and that if we're going to make progress on any of the difficult issues that we encounter in life, that we're going to have those conversations with people we disagree with, rather than focusing most of our conversations just on the people we agree with.
Okay. That leads me to think, this isn't among the questions that I sent you, so be warned. I think you're more than capable of answering it, though. So, I mean, we work in mental health here at the Hogg Foundation, and what that can entail turns out to be something that's pretty hard to reduce to a single tagline, even though we have one, you know, advancing wellness and recovery in Texas. But what does that mean exactly? And so what you find, or at least what I found, is that on any given issue, there are going to be those who have a deeper stake in it. So, for example, you know, the whole issue of seclusion and restraint, or let's just say forced treatment, anything that falls under that heading. And there seems to be a point at which, just for the sake of intellectual honesty, you have to kind of admit that not everyone has the same stake in an issue. And I just can't help but wonder how that might in some ways complicate the ability to have the kind of conversation that you're talking about, and if that's something that has ever been brought up to you or that you ever think about.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly true that particularly as you begin to have discussions that get closer to influencing public policy, that it gets harder and harder to have pure conversations, because the opinion that is ultimately rendered matters a lot. So one of the things I guess that I recommend is to try to have as many of these conversations as possible, as far away from the context of having to express an opinion in a public policy context as possible.
Right.
So that the stakes are lower and you can just try to share information. Again, you don't have to ultimately agree with people. As you get closer to a decision point, particularly, as I say, if you're trying to influence policy or allocation of resources or practice in a field, that at some point you still may fundamentally disagree with someone, but that disagreement has a lot more respect behind it if you at least understand where somebody's coming from and understand the influences on them.
Okay. Dr. Art Markman, his show, Two Guys on Your Head. I'm sure you've heard of it. Be sure to take every opportunity that there is to catch it. We very much appreciate you finding the time to come in and speak with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ike. It's great to be here.
And that does it for this episode of Into the Fold. Before I go, I would like to leave you with this. Shortly after the election, I deleted my precious Twitter app from my phone. Why? Because it had reached a point where it did little more than rile me up without necessarily adding new information. There's only so much analysis one can consume before it starts to resemble the ruminating that anxious people like myself are already prone to. And besides, I don't need more analysis. I need to start doing things. And I suspect that there are many others who are in the same boat. So, as much as I'm loath to dish out advice, I would say, tend your informational ecosphere the way you would a garden. Those things that have always been worth doing, keep doing them. Do them harder. Do them with love. Above all, take care of yourself. Don't give up hope. This is Ike Evans.